1, 2, 3. Acoustic Encounters with David Nogrisman and Danny Barnes. Hello, acoustic music lovers. You're listening to Acoustic Encounters for the 50th show today.
That's amazing, Danny. This is David Nogrisman, and we've made it through 50 of these
50.
Things.
Today we're talking about the original David Nogrisman Quintet.
That's right, and we're celebrating the 50th year from when that band started.
Lordy.
Just right around this time, Tony Rice moved to California into my basement around October of 1975.
Was he in Kentucky previously to that?
Yeah, he was living in Lexington, Kentucky, playing with J.D. Crowe in the New South.
Is that where that Holiday Inn was, or that hotel?
They probably played the Holiday Inn, but when I met Tony, they were playing the Sheraton Inn in Lexington.
Can you tell us a story about when Tony first told you he was going to come work with you? He was on tour.
I met Tony when Bill Keith made his first album. We both were on those sessions, and I had a tape of the Great American Music Band, the kind of forerunner of my quintet. A band that I had with Richard Green, where we decided to just play all instrumentals. And I had written a lot of original tunes, and as soon as I had an outlet for that, I wrote a whole bunch more. So I had a tape of this band and played it for Tony, and he was totally taken with that music and invited me to come back to Lexington, Kentucky, and wanted to learn those tunes. So I did that and spent several days in Lexington with him. And at night, we'd go down to his gig at the Sheraton Inn.
Wow.
That's where I met Ricky Skaggs and Bobby Sloan. It was just a quartet.
Wow.
At that time.
J.D. Crowe.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been amazing.
Yeah, it was.
That's kind of a legendary story about those gigs, people that got to see us all.
Well, it was kind of depressing because they, during the week, there's hardly anybody there.
Wow.
And here's like one of the greatest bands in bluegrass, and there's like seven people in this lounge in a motel.
A little bit of a grim scene, kind of?
You could see that by around the second or third set, they just were kind of joking around and... Those guys kind of like to sing out of tune and play out of tune.
No,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, they would kind of mimic bad bands.
Oh, no.
Anyhow, Tony kept calling me after that. When's the gig? When's the gig? And, you know, what gig? I didn't quite get what he was...
That's his exact phrase was, when's the gig?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So they were going to be going to Japan. This was probably late summer of 75. And they had a gig in San Francisco, a place called Paul's Saloon, the Bluegrass Tavern in San Francisco. So I told Tony, well, why don't you come out a few days earlier and we'll do some playing, because I already had Todd Phillips playing second mandolin and Daryl Anger, and Joseph Carroll had been the bassist in the Great American Music Band. And these guys would just come over to play these tunes. So Tony showed up a few days before the Paul's Saloon gig, and we played for several days, and they went off to Japan. And sometime during that next week or so, the phone rang about 3 a.m, and it was Tony. And he told me he just gave JD his notice and was going to move to California to play my music. It kind of blew my mind, but I embraced it. You know, what are you going to do when the world's greatest flat picker volunteers to come play your stuff?
How old do you reckon, roughly, he would have been? Early 20s right there?
Well, he was born in 1951, so that would have made him 24 years old.
Yeah, young 20, yeah.
I was about 30, and Todd and Daryl were younger, and Joe Carroll was older than all of us. He was probably around 40 at the time. He moved out there, and he and his wife, Kate, moved into my basement.
Did your landlord squawk about that?
The landlord never knew, I guess.
So you had these guys, did you just practice every day and practice all the time?
Yeah, once Tony got there, we got down to business, and those guys would show up every day, and we just rehearsed for about 3 months.
Wow.
And we played our first gig, I think, January 6th, 1976. And there's a few tracks that I released on DGQ20 on cassette at that very first gig.
Where was that at?
That was in Bolinas, California, a real small town near Stinson Beach, where I had been living for a couple of years. It was the Bolinas Community Center. Those first gigs were played without amplification.
Cool.
Just totally acoustic. That was recorded on a cassette, and it was good enough to release.
Do you mind me asking, was the PA-less reality something that the venue had going on, or is that just the way you did it, or did you want to do it that way, or was it an accident? Like, how did that come about, not using a PA?
I didn't have a PA, and that's the way we rehearsed in the living room.
That's cool.
We would just face the audience, and whoever was playing a solo would step forward. At some point, I guess we started playing places that had a PA system. I never really had a PA system.
I got one, David.
Yeah, it was acoustic music.
Man, that's cool.
And that first gig was sold out, too.
Wow, right off the bat.
Yeah, right off.
Did people sort of know who all the artists were?
They knew me from Olden in the Way, so, you know, which had been a few years before that, so... I was getting fan mail from Japan. There was quite an enthusiastic bluegrass audience in Japan. One of the first tours the original quintet did was a Japanese tour. Hiroshi Asada, the promoter, recorded all the gigs and wanted to release albums of it. I took all the master tapes home. And decided, unfortunately, that none of it was good enough.
Do you think the plan was good enough?
I just thought it hadn't matured to the point. You know, it was a new thing. I still have the tapes.
That's far out that you got it, though. I mean, just having that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, there were two guys who were record distributors. They wanted to put out those tapes. And I said, I really want to do it in a studio. And so, the end of 76... And by that time, Bill Imatnik had replaced Joe Carroll in the band. Mm. And that's when that first album was made.
How did it come about that you would record this and you had access to it?
This tape, I believe it was kind of a demo to try to get a record deal. Because this was right after Tony came out, within a month. I'm not sure how many rehearsals we had, but we needed a tape to try to get a record deal. These recordings were made as a demo.
In your living room?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Probably on Tony Rice's Sony machine. Yeah.
That's so cool that he had one with him.
Yeah. I think I had a Revox.
Revoxes are good ones.
Yeah. It might have been made on that.
It was made on a reel-to-reel machine.
Yeah.
Like a quarter-inch machine?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Stereo or?
Yeah, stereo.
Who was the tape op? Whoever was sitting close to it?
It's 50 years ago, Danny.
I'm just curious. Whoever was sitting by it?
Probably. I'm not sure who pushed record, but, you know, there were a lot of tapes made in the living room that way. Mm. In any case, these tapes sat on my shelf for many years, and I had Neville transfer them, and they sounded pretty good, so.
I'll say.
I figured that would make an interesting release.
Can we listen to some stuff?
Sure. What would you like to listen to?
I kind of like that Dog's Rag.
Oh, Dog's Rag.
Yeah. There's two takes of Dog's Rag, and they're 1 second apart in length, which I think is interesting.
That's amazing that they're the same length, because it's not...
It's really long,
it's
too.
Not, it's a long piece, and it's kind of arbitrary, some of those
sections.
There's
a lot of movements, too. There's a bunch of parts.
It was never really established how long this is supposed to go for, some of it.
The odds of that are pretty high, David. 10:37 and 10:36. Amazing.
Wow. We want to start with that? It's kind of long.
It's kind of a heavy song.
Well, that's a song that the Great American Music Band played.
Whoa.
I probably wrote that maybe even in 1973 or early 74. Anyhow, well, let's listen to take one.
Dog's Rag.
Thank you. Man, that's a good sounding living room you got there. Band sounds good in there. Well, I like the tight sound. It's neat. Just a couple of mics and a reel-to-reel machine. It sounds like that.
Yeah.
Good tone.
I don't think everybody had a mic. You know, bluegrass musicians learn how to work microphones.
Yeah, and there's no struggling to hear anybody. All the parts are real plain.
It was kind of a new way of using bluegrass instruments. There's a lot of influences in there. There's a part where the violin imitates the mandolin. That comes from Indian music. And those ragas, it'd always be a place where the solo of sitar or sarod would have a dialogue like that with the tabla.
Oh, yeah. Now yeah. I know what you're talking about. I think
yeah, that's where I swiped that from.
Was this like a big experiment, or did you, how did you come up with, like, this music? Was it just what you wanted to do, or did you think, this is something I'm driven to do because of something, or what?
I don't know. I just came up with these tunes, and some of them were longer and had sections.
You must have known you were onto something when these great players were getting their teeth in them and all.
I was devoting all my energy to this.
When you went to a record label with this tape here, what did they say?
My manager, Craig Miller, he was pitching this tape to record companies. I know we got turned down by pretty much everybody.
Who ended up doing it? Who ended up putting out the
quintet
record?
Well, these two guys who were distributors for Flying Fish Records, for small folk labels in the Bay Area, Jeff Alexson and Tom Diamant, started their own record company to put this record out, Kaleidoscope Records.
Neato.
I guess we had to prove ourselves, you know. I know I got turned down. One of the labels was A&M. And then after the Kaleidoscope record came out, it was very successful in that world.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think it sold about 50,000 copies.
Wow, that's a lot, yeah.
Over the course of a year or so. And by that time, A&M got interested.
When you're listening back and you listen to these recordings and then the ones that you ended up ultimately were on the record, do you see a lot of progression, or does it sound pretty much the same to you, or what is it?
This was kind of the first stab at it.
The record was more developed for you? Instead.
A little bit. I mean, that's the one thing. Music, if you keep working on it, it usually gets better.
This record we're talking about here, though, was really early on in the quintet.
Yeah, this was the first recordings.
From the listener's perspective, it's all there, man. You can hear everything. When you're listening to it with headphones on, it sounds like you're at your house.
Well, I think when you're in a comfortable environment there, and we probably were all like in a circle, we could really hear good.
Yeah, you're all in the same space and everything.
It's just a different vibe. This was like rehearsing, which, as you know, I just like working on music. I don't necessarily that crazy about performing, you know? 'Cause
I understand that.
There's kind of some other pressure on you to be an entertainer.
Right.
I mean, I had to embrace it to be in this business, but I just like working on it.
I'm the same way. I really love doing it just for doing it, you know?
That's really the meat and potatoes of music, is focusing and playing a gig. It's something else.
Yeah, y'all were free to just play in your living room and all. And
yeah, we could focus on music.
Y'all are really breathing together, too. Like, there's, you know, places where the music's really breathing. It's not just gritted out, you know.
It was pretty well formed. It was the time for me to do this. Mm-hmm. I had these tunes. I had these ideas about arranging. You know, that's what I liked about producing records is, I mean, record producers do a lot of different things, different ones. Some are engineers. Some are businessmen. Some are, you know, contractors, really. They know who to call. And some just sit there reading the sports page while somebody's out there making a hit. Mm-hmm. Some are arrangers and really deal with the music. And that's what I liked about being a record producer. You know, I could put a band together and say, well, you come in here or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And here I had a bunch of young guys were really passionate about this.
And you could see that there was, like, potential in it.
They were there because they liked it. And that's the one thing that money can't buy, somebody's passion. That's why I did it, because talented people showed up wanting to do this, you know.
Yeah, they wanted to move in with you.
And they didn't, you know, they didn't ask for a salary or anything like that. So I said, when we start playing gigs, I'm going to split even with you. Until I can afford to pay each of you guys $100. It took a while.
Yeah, especially in those kind of dollars, too. Hey, let's listen to, can we listen to Dog's Bull?
Sure.
That's got a few 16th notes in there. Yeah. Man, 2 minutes and 32 seconds
went by pretty quick. Woo! That didn't really make it onto a record until Hot Dog. Mm. And by that time, I had devised this intro for it. I think that arrangement, that opening fiddle lick, I think Richard Green played it that way in the Great American Music Band. Oh. See, Daryl had followed that band around and had made tapes of it. And he learned all of Richard's parts.
Daryl living in the West Coast at that point?
Yeah, oh yeah. He was living in Santa Cruz. He and Todd knew each other. And Todd told me, I have this friend that really digs your music. He's a good fiddle player. Could I bring him over to meet you? You know, he brought Daryl over. This stuff was in the incubator for quite some time. And in fact, I used to know a guy, I can't remember his name now. He lived on a houseboat in Sausalito. And he worked for an ad agency, and he wanted us to make a demo for Shasta Soda. And I used this tune, Dog's Bull. And he had lyrics in Tony Rice, Open Your Mouth, America. Because yeah. Shasta's coming through. Yeah, I used Dog's Bull for that, probably before it landed on Hot Dog.
I see.
Yeah.
And Dog's Bull, it has a little bit of a reference to an earlier Flat Scruggs tune.
Actually, the bridge is kind of similar to Shenandoah Breakdown.
What about Durham's Bull? Is there a little bit of...
I got the name from Durham's Bull.
But not the music.
Yeah. It's really a bluegrass tune, but the head there has got some kind of
some
different...
Some syncopation going on.
Yeah, syncopation. And I figured out three parts for it. There's just two there. I'm probably playing the harmony. And Todd's probably playing the melody on that. But on the Hot Dog, I played all three parts. The baritone is the toughest one.
You played all the parts on that?
On the Hot Dog recording, yeah. That's where I gave myself tendonitis because I decided I was going to play all the mandolin parts on that recording. And after 4 days of playing rhythm tracks with a lot of bar chords, and I just kind of burned up my arm doing that. Gave myself tendonitis. And fortunately, I had been corresponding with Mike Marshall, who was a young kid in Florida who had a little music store, and he was ordering the quintet album.
Wow.
And selling them. And I said, if you ever come to California, look me up, you know. And Tony Rice had heard him play the mandolin. He kept telling me, this kid can really play the mandolin. And he showed up, and I had stopped playing because I had tendonitis. And I was right in the middle of doing this Hot Dog record and King of the Gypsies. And I immediately recruited Mike to play some parts for me.
That's nice.
And Todd Phillips switched over to bass. There were quite a few transitions. Mm-hmm. I just always liked all kinds of music. And I had ideas from all kinds of music. I like classical music, and I like jazz, and I like bluegrass, and I like folk music, and I like Indian music. All of it. I stole ideas from all of that, you know? But I also realized that somebody like Tony Rice, he had his own way of playing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really want to change that.
It seemed like a really good fit for your music to have him there.
Yeah,
right there.
I mean, it could have gone lots of different ways, and that would have been okay. But I had Tony Rice there. I wasn't going to waste time trying to get him to play like Django Reinhardt on a song that might be more in that vein. Mm-hmm. The way he did it was fine. In fact, it was maybe better because it was so different. On that first album, a tune like Blue Midnight, consider a jazz tune, or actually one of these tunes.
1616?
Yeah, 1616. That's, kind of.
I think I heard them play that on the jazz radio station, as a matter of fact.
Well, it's really, to me, a Latin samba, you know.
Can we listen to 1616?
Sure.
That was a good year.
16,
good
16.
Year for the Baroque period.
Well, I'll tell you.
It was a rough time.
I'll tell you the story of the title after we listen to it.
Yes, sir. Track has got kind of like where y'all are sort of jamming a little bit too. It's got the feel that y'all are kind of sort of hanging out with the music a little bit.
Well, that was kind of a concept that I wanted to explore, having a certain progression just cycle over and over and over again, have people solo on it. I mean, it's got a very short melody, or the A part, you could say. It's kind of like a bebop bunch of licks.
It's a great listen because I like the way y'all are kind of still working things out a little bit, you know? There's a little bit of feeling the way through, but man, it's certainly fully formed, you know?
You know, I ultimately recorded this for the first time with Stefan Grappelli on Hot Dog.
This track?
Well, this tune, yeah, 1616. Oh, yeah, and I was going to tell you how the name 1616 got there. We were rehearsing this tune, and Tony and I took a break, and we drove down to Howard Johnson's, you know, 28 flavors, and we went down there to get some ice cream for the rehearsal. And that ice cream must have cost $3.84.
Because you give them a 20 and that was the change?
Yeah. We were standing at the cash register, right? And I gave him a $20 bill, and we were having a discussion about this tune and about 16th notes. And up popped 1616 on the cash register, which was the change. So I called the tune 1616.
Well, did you say one time you were in an ice cream store and Jerry Garcia walked in, you were in a Baskin Robbins?
Yeah, well, that was kind of related that, you know, when Tony came that first time to rehearse, I was rehearsing with Todd and Daryl and Joe Carroll at my house. And I went down to this one was at the Baskin Robbins. I guess I've always loved ice cream. Ice cream is a big part of dog music. It's played a big part. And anyhow, I went down to Baskin Robbins to get some ice cream, and Jerry was there. This is a true story. And I said, I got these guys up at my house, we're jamming. You want to come up and play? And he came up. And we jammed for a couple hours, and then I had to leave to go pick up Tony Rice at the San Francisco airport, and I didn't see Jerry Garcia for, I don't know, 12 years, or play with him.
Wow.
It's like Tony walked in and Jerry walked out.
Wow.
You know, it's kind of musical adolescence that we were all going through. Jerry, he just was doing the Grateful Dead, and I was developing this, and we didn't get back together for a long time. Till the dust had cleared. You know what we should do is listen to a couple of things from the first gig, you know?
Yeah.
Because that's kind of a progression. Here we're rehearsing, and after 3 months of the living room, we're ready to bring this to the people.
That sounds good.
At the Bolinas Community Center in Bolinas, California. Let's listen to the intro.
This group has two mandolins in it. Over here on the mandolin is Todd Phillips. And Todd actually built the mandolin he's playing, so he's totally responsible for that sound.
He just finished it an hour ago.
Right, he really did. He's still working on it, actually. On the bass, holding this whole thing down, is Joe Carroll, Marin County. Over here on the violin, one of my good friends, Daryl Anger. And on the guitar here, when I met him, he was living in Lexington, Kentucky, and he decided to migrate out here and play this music. So I'm real glad he did. His name is Tony Rice.
Yeah, okay, on mandolin, this is David Grisman.
Thank you. I'd like to try to do this next tune. It's the first tune I ever wrote about 12 years ago, and it's pretty hard to play, actually.
I like how you said it's pretty hard to play. It is pretty hard to play.
We might as well listen to that.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, that's acoustic?
Yeah.
Just acoustic. Wow. Yes. Right into the cassette. All right. You can hear everything really good. What do you think about going back over and listening to these tapes and stuff like that?
Well, you always ask me that.
I know. I just think it's interesting.
Well,
I wonder what you think about from your position.
Well, I hear the improv. You know, I've got a critical ear, so I tend to pick up on what's wrong with this picture rather than really appreciating it the way somebody else might. That's just, you know, so on this stuff, this early stuff, I can't.
Ma'am, is anything all right?
There's no such thing as perfection, I don't think. I could maybe pick out a few cuts that I've made through the years that they might not be perfect, but they did the job of delivering that song or whatever. But the great thing about music is that you get another chance tomorrow.
Maybe I should quit asking you that. I'm always just curious as to, because some time has passed and everything, mm-hmm. and you're seeing it in hindsight. And,
yeah.
You know, just wondering what, you know, you put all this work and time into it in this particular spot, right. And over here, what does it look like from over
this
there?
This project, Danny, is in my history. It's a document that documents the beginning of this. And it's the first recordings. And it wasn't made to be a record. I mean, I kept putting that off until I thought this music was at a point where I could be happy with that result. So this is
not quite there.
Yeah, not quite there for me. So, but I still, you know,
man,
it's,
I think
nostalgia.
It's really great.
It's always,
and just as a fan, it's really interesting because it's like slightly different renditions of things that you know real well, and it's nice hearing y'all figuring it out.
Yeah. I have these tapes. I kept them for years. I never threw anything away. I think there's somebody out there that would like to hear it. Not doing anybody any good sitting in a box on a shelf, you know.
Yeah.
It's part of my history, and I've got the luxury of having one of the most self-indulgent jobs in the world at the age of 80, you know, going through my memories here and and sharing them, you know, for whoever is interested.
Man, the music's so good on this
stuff.
Oh,
I'm glad you like it, man.
First recordings live in Dog's living room. 50 years. It's been 50 years.
Yes, 50 years, and this is our 50th podcast.
Whoa.
And I think we're about to get our 50th listener. I appreciate it, Danny.
I appreciate you, David. Thank you, David. Thanks for putting this music out. We'll talk soon.
All right.
That's all we have time for.